I cannot remember when I first read Funes the Memorious, the short story by Jorge Luis Borges that considers total and overwhelming recall. Labyrinths has, it seems, always been with me. I have bought, or I have been given, several copies of that book over the years. I do not consider myself a collector, though I have a house and an office full of books. If I were a collector, Labyrinths would be, I am sure, the book upon which my monomania would fix. What I am to tell you concerns the conjunction of an audio tape and an empty room. Last year, let us say, I was invited to participate in an archival project. My doctoral supervisor had recently died, and his papers required cataloguing. Too large a task for one scholar, I was asked to work through several box files of audio cassette tapes. Over 5 years, my supervisor had slowly been retreating into blindness, a hereditary condition that he had anticipated and attempted to circumvent. Through recording on audio tape rather than writing or typing, the professor embarked on producing his own aural archive, and it was this that I was to catalogue and annotate. My first task was to locate a tape player, as I'd long ago abandoned cassette tape and wholly embraced the clean, spaceless constellations of the digital archive. My first thought was to find the kind of machine once used by audio typists, who transcribed spoken dictation onto paper using machines the typist could pause with a twitch of her foot. This treadle, or foot switch, something akin to powering an acoustic bicycle, enabled even the most challenged touch typist to keep up with the flow of dictation. Sadly, my inquiries in this matter soon proved fruitless. Such machines were beyond even legacy status and were now utterly obsolete. I wondered whether the professor had considered the technological obsolescence of his own archive increasingly vulnerable to inaccessibility. I am happy to report that I managed to find a working Philips tape recorder, the type with piano keys, in a dusty storeroom of the sociology department and, with the delicate ministrations of one of the older secretarial staff, who was something of an audiophile, the machine was returned to working order. Having sourced some cassette tapes, I did notice a curious anomaly in its performance, however. In the early stages of annotating the professor's tapes, I thought to repeat his own procedure by recording brief notes on tape myself at the end of research sessions. Making an error in dictation, I rewound to an appropriate branching point and recorded over, as I thought, my previous words. Through some deficient operation of the recording head, the first recording was not erased, but simply overwritten, resulting in a palimpsest of voices. I saw that this would impose an unlooked-for discipline to my recorded thoughts, if I had no opportunity to erase and start again, and I soon abandoned the procedure, reverting back to notebook and pencil. The first series of tapes, which were dated 1995, were direct reproductions of the professor's voice, a warm baritone. I hardly think the tape had been played once since recording, so clearly and sonorously did his voice rise from the machine's small speaker. He spoke, as I remembered, from our supervisions, with certitude and exactness. He had served for years as the head of department, and this tape, recorded soon after he stepped down, reflected his commanding presence and character. He announced himself happy with the direction his research was taking, the time and energy he now had to inform these projects, and a renewed enthusiasm for the competitive nature of his chosen field. He mentioned two colleagues and competitors, most notably Professor A. Doriza and Dr. Athers, with whom he maintained a disputatious, if cordial, relationship. A dozen sessions passed in listening to the professor's thoughts, recorded intermittently over the course of an academic year. The tone and matter was unvarying. I must confess to a sense of lassitude towards the end of these sessions. The warmth of the professor's voice, and in no little effect the repetitious matter of the recordings, often brought on a state of ennui, only relieved by a pot of strong coffee and a brisk walk across the university square to the library. Such innovation sapped my enthusiasm for the project, and I began to regret accepting the invitation. My attention strayed to other matters, and progress slowed. I relay this in order for you to understand my relation to the professor, who, in provoking my disaffection from beyond the grave, seemed to repeat the worst periods of my doctoral study. One December evening, close to Christmas, I abandoned the effort entirely. I gave myself over to the holidays and the products of the distillery. Returning to the box files in the new year, I noted a large gap between the spring of 1996 and the winter of 1997, some 18 months. The tape manufacturer had changed, and the writing on the inlay card was thicker and more deliberate. I restarted my efforts with the first dated tape of 1997. As I listened, the professor was revealed to be a changed man. The baritone voice was sharper, the sentences more halting, the syntax often awry. He no longer spoke of Professor A. de Riese or Dr. Athers. His attention was entirely focused on something that had happened while he had been recording his dictation on 14th of November, 1997.
My God, man. How could this be explained? I reassert. Up again to record. I got my notes, which were on the dining room table. I retrieved them. Then back, the recognition. I'd left the machine running. Stopped recording and then skipped back, but I did not go far enough. As I pressed play on the machine, I heard a voice on the tape. That voice was not my own. God, who was it? What was it?